Thank you very much for inviting me back. And I'd like to give an overview of the wartime German atomic bomb program. This is an updated version with a number of new archival documents, including some that were actually declassified as recently as 2024.
Great. All right.
And this information comes from archives all around the world, US, European, even Australian archives. I've found some of this information, but many other people have also helped in finding this information. So I do strongly encourage anyone else who's interested to go digging and see what they can find. And I should also point out that everything here comes from entirely unclassified or declassified documents. Now, I know that I'm going to blow through all these documents, all this evidence at about warp 8, but people shouldn't be dismayed by that. So I encourage everyone to go to my website. The website address is here, and you can download all these slides and a whole lot more. There are extra deleted scenes. There's a special making of featurette you can see. So please download all that, and I'm going to blow through this. So the wartime German program, if you read most history books, the program was quite small and very primitive and never really got terribly far compared to the Manhattan Project. But it's been quite difficult for historians to really reconstruct the wartime German nuclear program for many factors. It was not just in one location, not even just in Germany proper, but it was spread all over German-controlled Europe. And on this map is a reminder of just how large the area was that Germany controlled during much of the war. So the program was scattered over that area, including even in several countries that were nominally neutral but were helping Germany, including Sweden, Switzerland, Portugal, and Spain. The program was also divided among many different government agencies. So the German army, the German Navy, Air Force, the SS, even the German Post Office, and many other groups. It was divided among many different companies, the chemical company IG Farben, the major electrical companies AEG and Siemens, various uranium-related companies, Degussa, Auer, Treibacher, and so forth. It was spread over many different research organizations, the Kaiser Wilhelm Institutes and universities all over the place. And it was also done in many underground facilities that were resistant to Allied bombing. So having the program set up like that made the German nuclear program much more resistant to Allied bombing and Allied intelligence, but it has unfortunately made it more resistant to modern historians trying to reconstruct all of this. There are other difficulties for historians. Toward the end of the war, the German forces destroyed or buried an awful lot of their work, an awful lot of their documents. And then what was found by many different organizations from many different countries, and then taken back to goodness knows where in all those different countries. And a lot of it is still classified here, even 80 years later. And then finally, simply, a lot of people are not terribly happy to rediscover all this. It tarnishes the modern public images of many of the countries involved, both Axis and Allied countries, as well as even neutral countries. So people don't really want to hear this terribly much, but I think it is very important history. Here is a recently rediscovered document. This is from a very top German nuclear scientist who came to the United States during the war. And this document ended up in Leslie Groves' files for the Manhattan Project. And according to this very highly placed scientist, no later than January 1938, the very top levels of the German military were actively recruiting scientists, even Jewish scientists, to develop nuclear weapons for Germany. As shown by this and a number of other documents, the German military was in charge of the nuclear weapons program from sometime in the 1930s until about 1942. And then in 1942, control of the program seems to have passed to the SS, Heinrich Himmler, and those guys. And for example, here is a post-war Allied interrogation report. They were interrogating one of Heinrich Himmler's top adjutants, top assistants. And according to his assistant, Heinrich Himmler in the SS had a panel of scientific advisors. And so he lists the panel of scientific advisors. There were 11 people. Of these 11 people, six of them were actually nuclear experts. and the other five were earth science experts with expertise quite relevant if you plan to go testing and deploying nuclear weapons. So it gives you some idea of what was on Himmler's mind. This is a memo from 1942. So, 1942, years before the end of the war. And this is a memo announcing an upcoming super secret meeting of Heinrich Himmler from the SS and Adolf Hitler and Wilhelm Ohrensorge, who led the nuclear program for the Reichspost, the post office. So these top people are going to get together in 1942 and discuss the latest German intelligence on exactly what the Manhattan Project is up to. Then, from 1938 until the very end of the war, spring 45, Germany obtained literally thousands of tons of uranium ores and thorium ores from sites all across Europe, including these. And this is shown by a number of different sources. And I should point out that Germany had access to the same sort of very high quality Congolese ore that the US used in the early phases of the Manhattan Project that was stored in Belgium and removed by the Germans. Germany also had access to all of the East German and Eastern European uranium mines that later supplied most of the uranium for the post-war Soviet nuclear weapons program. So they had the same sort of uranium that the US did for the Manhattan Project. They had the same uranium mines that were used for the post-war Soviet nuclear weapons project. And they even had access to additional mines, such as in Portugal, which I believe were later used for the British nuclear project. So they had lots of uranium available to them. And then, according to these documents, that uranium was shipped by plane. It was so urgent, it had to be sent by plane, not by train or by truck or something, but shipped directly by plane and to a number of different destinations. There were at least 20 different reported sites scattered all over German-controlled territory where uranium and thorium were processed. And these documents say that it was processed to uranium metal, it was processed to uranium hexafluoride, just as was used there at Oak Ridge to enrich uranium. And so processed to a variety of compounds with high throughput processes, all described here. And here's a description of just one of these facilities that has over 1,000 people working on processing uranium there, plus all these other facilities. So it's a very large operation to process the uranium. But of course, uranium also needs to be enriched. And there are several different methods to do that. According to the unclassified literature, the most energy efficient method to enrich uranium is centrifuges. And what most people don't realize is that gas centrifuges were invented in Germany sometime before 1895. It's mind-boggling, but before 1895, they invented gas centrifuges. And then by World War II, there were groups producing uranium gas centrifuges for isotope separation all over the place. There were at least two different groups in Kiel. There was a group in Munich mass producing uranium gas centrifuges, one in Freiburg, one in Göttingen, one in Thuringia, one in Breslau, now called Rohklau. Surprisingly, there were factories in Switzerland, nominally neutral Switzerland, that were mass producing gas centrifuges and then exporting them back to Germany. So it's a very important question, just how many gas centrifuges total did Germany build during the war and then use during the war? That's just one method of enrichment. A different method is electromagnetic separation called calutrons in the US. And these calutrons, of course, were widely used at Oak Ridge in the Y-12 facility starting about 1944, 1945. Here is a German calutron. This was an actual photograph of a German prototype calutron built, tested, demonstrated in 1941. And this was designed and built by the German scientist Manfred von Ardenne. And here is a document from Leslie Groves' files in the Manhattan Project showing that after the war, Samuel Goudschmidt, working for Leslie Groves, found multiple 1942 reports on these German calutrons. And I'd love to read those reports, but those reports are still classified and buried here 80 years later. Here's a report we do have. This was one of Funder Dunn's associates.
Todd, excuse me.
Yeah.
Do you know where those documents are?
I have the cover letter here, but the actual reports mentioned in the cover letter are not with it, and there's not even so much as a withdrawal card. At U.S. National Archives, sometimes if a document is still classified, there's a card saying, yes, we have it, but no, you can't see it. There's not even so much as one of those cards available for this.
Oh, so there's nothing available. I'm going to be having lunch with Dick Groves, General Groves' grandson, and I'm going to share this information with him and see if he's even seen this document. So that's why I was asking.
Yes. Yes, please do. I've heard of him. I've never talked to him. I would love to talk to him. I probably have a number of Leslie Groves related documents that he's not seen, and I would hope that he has a lot of related documents that I've not seen. So I'd love to swap archival documents with him.
I'll make that connection. I'll talk to him when he's coming to Oak Ridge next week. So we'll have a conversation about you.
Great. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Now, one report we do have is from one of Manfred von Arenna's associates, Heinz Ewald, from March 1942. And this is a very detailed document where he does calculations for how to obtain the optimal performance from a calutron. And then from von Arenna's own autobiography, we know that in 1941, after he demonstrated this prototype calutron, he went to German industry. With the backing of German government, trying to persuade some of the large German electrical companies to mass produce these calutrons. Now, in his autobiography, he's too coy to actually state what actually happened after that. But we have this report also from Leslie Groves' files. This is an intelligence report stating that during the war, the Reichspost, for which von Arenna had worked, had then built three new labs loaded with high voltage equipment for nuclear purposes, and they put von Arenna and another top nuclear scientist, Siegfried Pflüger, in charge of it. So it sounds as if they built three different locations with calutrons. And then lending further support to that, this is from the U.S. Army Air Force's General Henry Arnold, who was in charge of bombing lots of German sites. And he wrote after the war that during the war, he had been assigned to go bomb various German sites that had, quote, electric machines that make it possible to complete the development of the atomic bomb. So that sounds like calutrons. So the US forces had apparently bombed some of these known calutron sites. Now, these were not the only people in Germany making calutrons, there were other scientists, other groups making calutrons. So again, a very important question is how many of these uranium enrichment machines were produced in Germany and used in Germany during the war? And then there's a third method. There's gaseous diffusion, also used at Oak Ridge. So gaseous diffusion was actually invented by the Nobel Prize-winning German scientist Gustav Hertz in 1923. 1923, so over 20 years before the end of the war. Here you see a gaseous diffusion cascade with multiple gaseous diffusion cells all, lined up in series. So this was the 1920s. Now, Gustav Hertz was of Jewish ancestry, and yet his work was deemed so important by the Third Reich that he was allowed to remain and work on the stuff throughout the war. And then after the war, he went to the Soviet Union and helped to build gaseous diffusion facilities for the Soviet Union after the war. He's not alone. There were a number of other Germans working on this, Erika Kramer, Erich Bagge, and others. This is a patent from the German uranium company, Auer Gesellschaft. And in 1940, they actually patented improved methods of doing diffusion enrichment. And then officially, we don't really know exactly what happened during the war. It's just a whole big blank in the history books and in the documents. But we know that at the end of the war, when Soviet forces marched into eastern Germany, they found a German village called Neustadt an der Oller. And in this village were factories that were uniquely skilled at producing the nickel membrane filters that you need for a gaseous diffusion plant. And so these German factories supplied all the nickel membrane diffusion filters for the post-war Soviet program. So what exactly were these German factories doing during the war with that? We also know, again from Leslie Groves' own files, that during the war, the Manhattan Project here in 1944 stated in writing that they believed that the German gaseous diffusion program was actually ahead of where Oak Ridge was at the time. And then, well, after the war, in September 1946, a year and a half after the end of the war in Europe, Leslie Groves personally sent Percival Keith, who, as you know, was the chief designer of the Oak Ridge K-25, sent Percival Keith on a super secret 2-week mission to Czechoslovakia. Now, why would you send the person who designed Oak Ridge to possibly be captured by Czech security forces or by Soviet security forces, unless there was something really urgent there that required his personal expertise? And so I think the best explanation for this is that there was probably a German isotope enrichment plant in Czechoslovakia, former German-controlled territory, and it was probably a gaseous diffusion plant, which is why they wanted Percival Keith there. But
Well,
all
back up to that, please. When is that? When does that letter?
This is from September 1946.
Now, September 46. So the war's over, been over a year.
Yes. Czechoslovakia is in a strange political state. It is nominally independent, but the Soviets are exerting a lot of control over it. The US doesn't have too much control, but from other documents, we know that the US is actually smuggling people in and out of Czech territory. And grabbing lots of goodness knows what German stuff from Czech territory and bringing it back to the United States.
Okay, all right, I understand. I just needed to get it in the time frame. I
Yeah,
got
sure.
it. Thank you.
It's a very interesting document, but I can find nothing else about this. So I'd love to hear from anyone else who might know about this, might have documents about this. But yeah, everything is so far still completely classified and buried. So those were the major enrichment methods. Now, in terms of where they would actually be set up, where the Oak Ridges were, obviously the Germans wouldn't want to build one big Oak Ridge. They might as well, put a giant target sign on the top of it for Allied bombers. So the practice would be to distribute their enrichment over a number of different sites. And especially to resist Allied bombing, they were building many underground sites. You'd expect that. And in fact, here is a report that that is exactly what the Germans did. This is a high-level OSS report from October 1944. And this secret OSS agent was able to schmooze with a lot of high-level German industrialists. And they were happy to blab, oh, yeah, we have lots of distributed underground factories that are doing uranium enrichment. Now, in this report for the OSS, it doesn't state where those factories were, but says that they were all spread around German-controlled territory. Fortunately, from other reports, we do know the locations or believed locations of many of those enrichment sites. This report, also from the OSS, states that there were two very large enrichment plants in eastern Czech territory. And these were large enough that each of these plants had 30,000 employees. So large-scale enrichment. There are also mentions of a plant with 30,000 employees in Thuringia in central Germany, and of a plant in Slovakian territory, of underground factories doing this in Landsberg in Germany that required so much power. They had a number of special power plants built to power them. There are reports of factories in Silesia and what's now Poland. Interestingly, there are reports of underground factories doing uranium enrichment south of Hamburg, and reports that these factories employed, hundreds or thousands of employees, making a very special new explosive with a blast radius of several kilometers. And this very special explosive was designed to go in a spherical bomb. Now, spherical bombs are not very aerodynamic, and so you only make a spherical bomb if the physics compels you to make it spherical. And I think you can probably think of one or two very special World War II bombs that were spherical. And then other intelligence here. These are intelligence reports on a site in Austria called Radelzip. And what's interesting about these reports is that they say that this site was taking in minerals, thorium, uranium minerals, and that this site had 200 what sounds like either centrifuges or gaseous diffusion cells. And through these 200 centrifuges or whatever they were running a very corrosive gas. Now, I think you can probably think of a very corrosive gas that was used at Oak Ridge. And so it describes this very corrosive gas had to be handled. It was toxic, and it was corrosive to all metals except for a very shiny metal like nickel. Probably sounds rather familiar to Oak Ridge people there.
Yes.
So there's uranium enrichment in order to get uranium for a bomb, but of course you can also breed plutonium or possibly uranium-233, and that can be done in a reactor. Now, for reactors, people are most familiar with Werner Heisenberg's reactor, which started off in the Berlin suburb of Dahlem and was later moved to Hygelac toward the end of the war. This reactor never went critical, and now it's a great tourist attraction. But you usually don't hear about all the other German reactors and all of the documents, all the evidence supporting these other reactors. So quite a number of these. One in Königsberg that was bombed especially by the Royal Air Force, and it appears to have been a large Hanford style breeder reactor setup. One that was reported in Kryzik or Bodenbach in Czech territory, according to documents that were declassified just last year. And then a very special one here in Gusen, Austria. Let me show you this. So Gusen's kind of in the middle of nowhere in Austria, but here is a U.S. aerial surveillance photo from just before the end of the war, March 1945. And it shows all the surrounding fields, shows that there's a large underground facility here. You can barely see signs of the tunnels, but as part of this large underground facility, there is this poking its nose out of the ground. And you see one or possibly two octagonal, what look like pool reactors, either under construction or operational. And adding evidence of German guilt here as Allied forces were approaching. So a month later, in April 45, here's an aerial surveillance photo of the same facility. Whatever this was, it was so important that before Allied troops got there, the Germans buried the whole thing. They filled it with earth and concrete. They buried the whole thing, and it remains buried and sealed to this day, 80 years later. But we do have a report from one of the companies involved in constructing this facility. And so in this report, they show what looks like these same sort of structures, and they label it two atomic piles. We also have this cover letter from post-war Allied investigations of this site. And they were so excited on the cover letter, they wrote underground pile with three underlines here. Now, I would love to read the report that went with this cover letter, but unfortunately, the report is still classified 80 years later. You can't read it. But we do have local train logs from 1944, 1945 in Austria showing that this site in Austria by train received massive numbers of shipments from other suspected German nuclear sites, and that was delivered to known German people here at this site. And then here is an interview with the son of the SS commandant of the facility, saying, yes, this was part of a larger underground facility that actually had 30 to 40 kilometers of tunnels where they could process the material coming out of these reactors in order to construct the atomic bomb. Now, reactors are not the only way to breed plutonium or uranium-233. You can also do it with enough particle accelerators. This is called electronuclear breeding. The U.S. had a large program in electronuclear breeding during the Cold War. And there's evidence that Germany did too during the war. Germany, for some reason, had a very high priority, very secret program to produce large numbers of particle accelerators all over German-controlled territory, everywhere from the Netherlands to Czech territory. And then there are multiple statements from people that they were using these particle accelerators in order to try to breed plutonium or uranium-233. and even statements that the Allies found out about this and bombed this program, trying to stop it. Then there's heavy water. And of course, everybody always hears about the Norwegian heavy water plant at Fimork, and how it was very heroically destroyed by Kirk Douglas and Richard Harris. But it's odd that you never really hear about the other 26 or so German heavy water sites that were scattered all over Axis territory. There were at least two others in Norway. There was one in nominally neutral Sweden shipping heavy water to Germany. There were these all over Europe. There were heavy water plants all the way down to southern Italy. But oddly, you never hear about these. But here is the documentation that these existed. So why was Germany producing heavy water at least 27 plants, despite their urgent wartime needs to be producing other things? It's just that the heavy water was very important, very urgently needed for breeder reactors or electronuclear breeders, or as fusion fuel, or for other purposes. And if you go looking for more details in archives, you find, yes, we have lots of reports on these heavy water plants, and no, you cannot see them. Withdrawal notice, access restricted. Withdrawal notice, access restricted. Withdrawal notice, access restricted. 80 years later, you still cannot read the official reports on these wartime German heavy water plants. Then there were a number of other nuclear-related materials that were also produced in Germany. And for a nuclear program, as you know, you need other things like lithium, beryllium, boron, graphite, fluorine for the uranium hexafluoride, aluminum, calcium to help in purifying the uranium, nickel, zirconium, cadmium as a neutron absorber. And we know that during the war, Germany produced all these materials in quantities of thousands of tons. And we know this by post-war Allied reports, where Allied investigators went into these factories after the war and said, tell us how much of the stuff you produced. It was thousands of tons. We even know that there were some sites, such as IG Farben's Bitterfeld facility, that were producing several of these nuclear-related materials all at the same site. That seems quite suspicious. And we know that since Germany was collaborating with Japan on a nuclear program, that we have shipments recorded where Germany was shipping by submarine to Japan at least 560 kilograms of uranium, which may have been enriched, but several of these materials along with it. They're also shipping lithium and stuff along with it. And we know that after the war, these very same German plants continued to produce these very same materials in order to supply the post-war U.S. nuclear weapons program and the post-war Soviet nuclear weapons program. So why were these plants producing these materials during the war? Who was their customer? We also can see documents about the required mass of fission fuel for a weapon. So the pit masses, the critical masses for a fission weapon. And we have a number of documents reporting that for an implosion design, which is the preferred German design in these documents, the required mass of purified uranium-235 or plutonium was in the range of a few kilograms. And in fact, these documents state not only did they know that mass, but state that they fabricated pits. So they made pits for nuclear weapons. They made several pits and reports the manufactured pit masses as being anywhere from 1 kilogram up to 8 kilograms. You can get a nice bang with 8 kilograms of uranium-235 or plutonium. Now, what designs would those go in? We have that information. In the archival documents so far, I found evidence for three different sizes of German nuclear weapons. This was the smallest size. This bomb had a mass of around 300 kilograms total. Very small yield, less than a kiloton, but you really wouldn't want it to go off at your house. And this was apparently tested in 1944, 1945. So here are versions of this design from two of the top German army scientists working on it, Erich Schumann, Walter Trinks. This was two-point ignition, so this was not a spherically symmetric implosion bomb, but this was an implosion bomb imploded from both ends, so a so-called two-point design, later used in more advanced nuclear weapons in the U.S. after the war. Here is a post-war report from the U.S. General Thomas Betts and the top British scientist Lindstedt here, and they report that these smaller nuclear weapons were intended to be mounted on German rockets, like V-2 rockets, and launched. And here is a report from one of Heinrich Himmler's adjutants, Werner Grotemann, his other major adjutant, reporting that these bombs were actually made and that they had a size and shape roughly comparable to a standard German 250-kilogram bomb called an SC-250 bomb. So here's a standard SC-250 from U.S. museums for comparison. So we should expect that if these things were built, they would look kind of like this bomb on the outside, but on the inside, they'd look like this, with explosives, conventional explosives, at both ends to squeeze, to compress, to implode a core of fission fuel. And in ALSOS documents, also from Leslie Groves' files, we have this. This is a report from a German who was captured by the Allies. And according to this German, in spring 1945, before he was captured, he saw a stockpile of very special bombs. And based on his experience, seeing the outside, the inside of these very special bombs, he drew what he saw on the stockpile. And look at this. It is two-point ignition with conventional explosives on both ends. And it has a pit here in the middle. And that pit is even surrounded by a heavy metal tamper in this. And he saw these things. He saw a stockpile of these bombs. That's the small version. Here's the medium-sized version. This had a mass of about 2,000 kilograms, 2 tons. This was spherical. It would have had a yield probably of tens of kilotons with a full load of fuel, and seems to have been tested in 1944 and 1945. And for comparison, here is the well-known U.S. Gadget or Fat Man design from purely unclassified sources. So the diagram of the bomb and the dimensions, the function of the various layers of this spherical bomb. This is the U.S. version. Here is the German version. We have a bunch of different sources now, from German sources, from former Soviet archives, from U.S. archives, a bunch of different sources that actually give us the details about this bomb design. We can put it side by side and see that it looks an awful lot like the U.S. Gadget or Fat Man, except in a few respects, it's more advanced. It has two neutron initiators that are both more advanced than the so-called Urchin neutron initiator that the U.S. used. And its method of using explosives appears to be more advanced, to get better better compression, better implosion than the U.S. version. And this was overall somewhat lighter than the U.S. bomb. This was 2 tons. The U.S. bomb was more like 3 tons. So this probably could have had a yield of several tens of kilotons if given a full load of fuel. It appears that the Germans, when they tested this, used as little fuel as possible, just enough to achieve criticality. They didn't want to use up too much of their precious fuel, and they probably didn't want to make too big of a mess on German territory or invite too much scrutiny by observers. Now, that's not simply a paper design, but you've seen the components of that design, and now I can tell you which specific German companies manufactured those components, or at least manufactured components that match the descriptions there. The first of the two neutron initiators was made by the CHF Mueller company in Hamburg, according to post-war Allied investigations. And again, this was much better than the Urchin that the U.S. version used. And the second neutron initiator was made by the Siemens electrical company in Erlangen. The uranium 235 fission pit was made by the sites we discussed earlier. The pit would have been surrounded by an unenriched metal uranium tamper, probably made by the Auer or Degussa companies in Oranienburg or elsewhere. That was surrounded by what's described apparently as cadmium electroplated aluminum. And from these post-war Allied investigations, we know the companies that were capable of manufacturing cadmium electroplated aluminum. The cadmium is there as a neutron absorber. And then the TNT and the RDX would have come from Wasag and Allendorf are the locations. The explosive lenses, using those two different explosives combined in a geometrical structure as a lens to optimize the implosion, they were designed by the German army and actually tested. So here are photographs of German explosive lenses being tested in 1943. The US didn't get serious about German explosive lenses until late 44 and early 45. Here's 1943. And then simultaneous detonators to set off all this, electrical detonators. Also, we know they were developed by the German army. And the explosives were supplemented with liquid oxygen to get better implosion. And there was plenty of liquid oxygen available from the V2 rocket program at Friedrichshafen and other places. So you've seen the small design, medium design, and then it also came in supersize. According to over 30 different independent sources, during the war, Germany was developing a full-scale H-bomb. It sounds hard to believe. It sounds like 1950s stuff in the 1940s. But according to these sources, Germany was developing a full-scale H-bomb using fusion fuel that was lithium deuteride. And I know that lithium was produced at Oak Ridge after the war. So they were doing similar things in Germany during the war. So lithium deuteride fusion fuel, according to these sources, and then a fission bomb primary. It even describes radiation implosion used in this. The bomb would have had a total mass of about 6,000 kilograms and a yield of about 1.6 or so megatons, so quite a big bang. And although this was not tested during the war, they were expecting to test it if the war continued later in 1945 or in early 1946. So this was far from a paper design. This is very close to actually being tested. So a very advanced German H-bomb. Now, the smaller bombs, the small and the medium, do seem to have been tested. The earliest successful reported test was from October 1944 on the Baltic coast. And we have reports from a number of independent sources of this test. So it's quite impressive. We have reports from Axis observers who were on the ground monitoring this test from a bunker nearby. We have reports from Axis observers who were assigned to be in the air observing this test. We have reports from the OSS. We have reports from the Manhattan Project. We have a number of different reports on this. The second apparent test happened about a month or so later in Poland. And again, we have a number of reports on this. According to these reports, it appears that the Germans unfortunately used humans as guinea pigs. They wanted to test the effect of the nuclear explosion on humans. So quite a very tragic event, but a number of reports describing this. And then the final tests seem to have occurred in Thuringia in central Germany in March 1945. And again, we have quite a number of reports. Most of these are Soviet intelligence reports that describe this test and describe the design in great detail. But there are also Allied reports from Allied intelligence describing the same thing, and from Heinrich Himmler's adjutant describing this as well. So quite a number of reports here. Now, people always see that and they say, great, let me grab my Geiger counter. I want to go out and go roaming around Germany with my Geiger counter and find where they tested this stuff. And goodness knows we'd like to do that. But from the physics, it's simply not possible. We know from well-known nuclear physics that the radioactivity from a nuclear explosion decays over time. And here it's been over 80 years now. So after 80 years, the radioactivity from this nuclear explosion or any of these would have dropped by about a factor of a billion fold from what they were immediately after the explosion. So if you do the math, you work out that if this actually happened, if you were to measure the residual radioactivity at the test site, it'd be around 10 to 30 times smaller than the natural background radiation levels. So you couldn't detect it with your trusty Geiger counter. That's if everything remained at the test site, kind of like Trinity. But these were tested not in the middle of a desert like Trinity, but, tested in the areas where there's lots of snow and rain and everything. So it probably washed stuff all over the place. It'd be even harder to detect. So it is very hard to prove or disprove these tests with modern methods. But if somebody out there has the resources to do this, has the money to do this, can persuade the German government to let them do this, I'd love to see somebody try. I think it may be possible to take soil samples from a number of different sites. And then since you can't look for overall radioactivity, that's too low, do very sensitive laboratory tests. And even if you can't see the fission products, maybe you can see other things from the bomb, like the very heavy natural uranium tamper that was blown to smithereens. So I'd really love to see somebody try that. If they have the resources, I would encourage them. Now, we know from quite a number of other documents that Hitler strongly supported all this nuclear weapons development. You often hear, well, Hitler didn't know about this. Hitler didn't care about nuclear weapons. Hitler didn't like nuclear weapons. No, we actually have quite a number of quotes from people in Hitler's inner circle that from 1939 until the very end of the war, spring 45, Hitler was very, very, very excited about the possibilities of nuclear weapons. And to further back that up, we have a series of photographs from German archives. This is Hitler surrounded by nuclear scientists. So he liked it enough, he was doing a photo op with nuclear scientists. This is Kurt Diebner. This appears to be Werner Heisenberg back here. Fritz Strassmann, one of the discoverers of fission. Rolf Widerow, a particle accelerator expert here. So doing a photo op with nuclear scientists at Linz, kind of the middle of nowhere in Austria, in April 1943, over 2 years before the end of the war. And I doubt that they were here to open a new discotheque. So this was at a facility called the Reichswerke Hermann Göring in Linz. We know absolutely nothing about what was produced at that facility, but from Leslie Groves' own records, we know that about a year and a half later, Leslie Groves was personally informed that whatever this facility was had been bombed flat by the Allies, and Leslie Groves appears to have been pleased enough at that intelligence that he put it in his files, and it was filed under positive intelligence, proof positive about the German nuclear weapons program. Then it appears from a number of sources that multiple nuclear weapons were not only tested, but completed and stockpiled and available by the end of the war if Hitler were sufficiently grumpy. So we have this testimony from a number of different independent sources that there were multiple nuclear weapons available. So the question is, why did Germany not actually use these nuclear weapons? And we even have the answer for that. We know that from 1943 until the end of the war, FDR and Churchill publicly threatened Germany that if they used any sorts of weapons of mass destruction, the Allies would respond by escalating the Allied bombing. They wouldn't simply do what they had been doing in the Allied bombing, but they would start dropping mustard gas and phosgene and really nasty stuff and potentially killing millions of German civilians. So it was mutual assured destruction, mad, kind of a post-war concept, but here during the war that appears to have deterred the Germans. So this was the Allied threat. And we know from multiple Axis sources that it worked, that Hitler decided not to use these nuclear weapons or to use his chemical weapons, which we also know he had, because of these threats. Then for the Allied side, we can see that the Allies very clearly believed in the existence of German nuclear weapons. And we can see from wartime Allied reports. This is from in the fall of 1944. So even showing up in Time magazine and the New York Times, they're reporting, hey, German scientists are developing a new spherical implosion bomb to implode uranium and have a blast radius of several kilometers. And it has a neutron initiator. They actually reported this unclassified in these Western media sources. And as you can imagine, when Leslie Groves read that in Time magazine, he kind of had a hissy fit. And so there's actually, you know, evidence about Leslie Groves' reaction to that when he discovered all this. And then here is from December 9th, 1944. This was one of FDR's secretaries reporting that on that day, FDR had been informed that Germany has developed a bomb with a blast radius of over a mile, and that this German program is greatly ahead of where the Manhattan Project was at the same time. This appears to have been a presidential briefing from 2 days later, from December 11th, 1944, one of only two copies of this, so eyes only, probably for FDR. And here is the summary page, followed by several pages of evidence. The first paragraph says that we have intelligence, we have evidence that Germany has developed atomic bombs and is working on methods of delivering them to Allied targets. And for this intelligence evidence, see tab A. So I thought, great, I really, really, really want to read this tab A. This must be great stuff. So you go to it, and nope, access restricted, withdrawal notice, yellow card, no soup for you. So even 80 years later, this evidence is still classified and withheld. There are many other examples of that. These were from post-war reports, and these came from a number of top military officials in both the U.S. and in Great Britain, stating, you know, based on their post-war investigations, they knew that Germany had been developing or had developed atomic bombs during the war, and could potentially have used them. So from Eisenhower and everybody else here. Now we have these public statements, but we don't have the actual reports based on that. And these are not the sort of people who would make these sort of statements just off the cuff or making things up. This must have been based on very, very detailed Allied investigation reports, but those are still classified and unavailable. On that note, where are all of the Allied reports on all of the suspected or known nuclear facilities in German territory during the war? Nuclear facilities that are cited by name in other reports, such as these. So here are some of the known or suspected German nuclear sites. If you ever feel like being a tourist in Europe, you can visit all of these. So here are named sites. And then after the war, we know that the Allies visited these sites. We know because they stopped to take selfies at these sites. So here's Monty, here's Eisenhower and so forth, Patton taking selfies at these sites. We know they were there, but we don't have any written reports for actually what they found there. You know, what was the site like? What were they producing? What was removed from the site? How about interrogations? There are no interrogation reports for personnel at these sites. It's all still classified and buried. Now, in addition to stuff that stayed there in Europe, there was stuff that was shipped out of Europe during the war, international shipments to Japan and possibly other destinations. We know from documents that Germany and Japan were collaborating on nuclear weapons and shipping material relevant to that from Germany to Japan. That was throughout the war. And then at the very end of the war, Germany dispatched at least 10 submarines loaded with the very latest weapons technology and materials to Japan. And of those 10 submarines, at least six were captured intact by the Allies. So where are those captured submarines? Where is everything that was captured on them? All the materials, all the documents that were captured on them? We have virtually nothing from those six submarines. Here is one of just a few pages available on just one of those submarines. And it says that the submarine was brought into port and it had uranium oxide, but not just any old garden variety uranium oxide like everyone has in their house, but this was uranium oxide that had to be stored in very special gold-lined cylinders, and that the German sailors on board told the Allies unloading the submarine, now be very, very careful with that uranium, handle it like TNT, it can become sensitive and dangerous if you mishandle it. So it certainly sounds like enriched uranium. That was just one item from just one of these subs. So it was on all these different submarines. And where are all the reports on that? And then personnel. Perhaps the closest analog of Leslie Groves in Germany was Hans Kammler. Hans Kammler was an SS general, also had a PhD in engineering. And by the end of the war, he was in charge of the German nuclear weapons program and other advanced weapons programs, as stated by multiple independent archival sources. He was the guy in charge of the nuclear program. Now, officially, he died in May 1945, which makes it kind of difficult to find out anything. But luckily, we have multiple reports from U.S. archives saying that, you know, no, not did he not die in May 45, but as late as many months later, he was alive and in U.S. custody and singing like a canary. So very sprightly for a dead guy. Now, we have these reports that he was being interrogated, but we actually don't have the details of those interrogations. So what did he say? What did he provide? And he was also implicated in many aspects of the Holocaust. So for the U.S. to harbor this person after the war, never turn him over to other countries who wanted him, never turn him over to the Nuremberg process, never admit that he survived the war, he must have provided something very, very important to the U.S. in exchange for all this. So where are all those reports? They're all still classified and buried. He was the top general in charge.
Do you know what happened to him?
Everybody wants to know what happened to him. So officially, he died in May 45. He was alive at least as late as November 45, so at least 6 months later.
Yeah.
And then after that, the paper trail just vanishes. People have done FOIAs for this, Freedom of Information Act requests. And the FOIAs return that there are at least two more Kamala-related documents. They're still classified. You can't see them, but at least mention that they exist. I think one was from the 1960s, and I think one from the early 1980s. And either one of those would be a plausible death date for Kamala if he lived a long natural life. So goodness knows. I mean, maybe they kept him in prison for his life. Maybe they kept him someplace in Europe. Maybe he lived happily ever after in Nebraska, for all we know.
Okay.
Everybody wants to know what happened to him, and there must be lots of documents on that, but they're not releasing them. Now, he was the top general for the project. This was the top scientist, apparently, for the project, Siegfried Pfluger. In 1939, he published detailed calculations about fission reactors and fission bombs, and he appears to have worked for all different aspects of this program. As I said at the beginning, the German nuclear program was distributed over many different sites, many different countries, many different agencies, and he was the indispensable man because, according to his resume, he was working at all of them. And we also know that after the war, in 1947, Edward Teller was trying to become the father of the H-bomb, and he was having a little trouble conceiving. And so here is a memo that Edward Teller in 1947 urgently requests that they go dig up Siegfried Pfluger in Europe and put him on a plane and bring him over to help Edward Teller. And by golly, they did. And this is a revolutionary. I mean, you read, you know, histories of the H-bomb development in the U.S. after the war. You never come to a chapter where Edward Teller throws up his hands and says, by golly, I'm stumped. Let's bring in the Germans who are building the German H-bomb. But here it is in black and yellow here on this aged paper. When Siegfried Pfluger was not in the U.S. helping his newfound buddy Teller, he was visiting home in Europe, and he was constantly kept under U.S. security and surveillance in Europe through at least the 1950s. Courtesy of one of the former top officials of the ALSOS mission. And those are just two examples, but there are many more. There are dozens of experts who would have had knowledge of the German nuclear program, including the H-bomb development program, who were brought to the U.S. and or U.K. We have their smiling photos. We don't have too much more. And then there were a bunch more that were perhaps never brought to the U.S., but were interrogated in Europe or were taken to other countries like France, UK, Soviet Union. And we have these brief mentions that, oh yeah, we just found out that this guy, that guy, the other guy was building nuclear bombs during the war. There must be very juicy follow-on reports about that, but those follow-on reports are all still classified. You can't read them. In fact, there's a lot you can't read. I showed you some of the yellow withdrawal cards from the U.S. National Archives earlier, access restricted, withdrawal notice. They put these to inform you, at least, you know, we have this wonderful document, and we're going to be rude to you. You can't read this wonderful document, but at least you know it exists. So here are all these different withdrawal cards for files from Leslie Groves on the German atomic bomb that you can't read 80 years later. They're all these and all these. And these, and these, and these. But wait, there's more. It slices, it dices. There are these, and these, and these, and these, and these, and these and these and a whole lot more where that came from. So if the German program was so small, so primitive, why do we have all of these documents about the German nuclear weapons program? And why are they still classified and withheld 80 years after the war? So again, if you read most modern history books, they say the German program to develop nuclear weapons was very small, very primitive, didn't get terribly far. But from the documents you've seen, from other documents on my website, here are examples of people who were in a position to know and who concluded that the German program was not small and not primitive. And its top U.S. officials, from FDR on down, all kinds of generals and other military officials, top scientists, Manhattan Project scientists, top investigative reporters from the U.S., all kinds of Axis people, from Adolf Hitler on down through officials, long list of scientists, other witnesses, top people in the UK from Churchill on down, all vouching for this, top people in the Soviet Union from Stalin's inner circle on down, all vouching for this. But wait, we also have Czech sources, we have Dutch sources, we have French sources, we have Polish sources, Swedish sources, Swiss sources. We have all kinds of different sources here. They're all saying the same thing. It's all been ignored by the history books. So to conclude, we have all of these archival documents stating that, at least according to these reports, during the war, Germany obtained thousands of tons of uranium and thorium ores on a very high priority basis and processed that at least 20 different sites and was manufacturing, mass-producing uranium gas centrifuges all over the place, and was employing tens of thousands of workers in plants to enrich uranium, and was building dedicated power plants to provide electricity for those, and was producing heavy water at least 27 different sites all over Europe, and was producing tens of thousands of tons of other nuclear-related materials, and was building apparently large underground octagonal pool fission reactors you can see with your own eyes on aerial surveillance photos, and was developing and testing spherical implosion bombs and explosive lenses from 1940 onward you can see with your own eyes in photographs, and was building mass-producing shipping neutron initiators that were even better than the ones the U.S. had for its bombs, and was conducting large test explosions, as reported by many different sources, and you can actually even see evidence from aerial surveillance photos, and was telling its top officials and leaders of other countries that Germany possessed or would soon possess nuclear weapons, and was developing delivery vehicles to carry those weapons to Allied targets. So if you saw some random modern country, let's call it Kyrplakistan, just to pick a random example. So you saw Kyrplakistan, it's not supposed to be a nuclear power, but you suddenly receive thousands of pages of intelligence from highly placed sources saying that Kyrplakistan is doing all these different things. Now, would you conclude that, oh, it's obvious from all that that Kyrplakistan has no nuclear weapons program and there's no need for us to investigate a possible nuclear weapons program there? No, I mean, you would conclude that we obviously have to look more into this. There's something really fishy going on in Kyrplakistan. So there's a lot more information on my website. I encourage people to look at that, but it's not the complete story by any means. In order to get the complete story, we have to get all these documents declassified and released. Some of them we at least know where they are. Some of them we don't even know where they are, but we know that they must exist, like interrogations of Hans Kammler and so forth. And so I'd encourage people to, you know, search for those documents, lobby to have those files released. And then for people who are in Europe or can potentially visit Europe, it'd be quite fascinating to conduct industrial archaeology digs at those dozens of different sites I showed on my map. Now, if you do that, you know, please dig very carefully. Goodness knows what there might be buried down there. But to be able to dig that up and then to do laboratory analyses on isotopes and things could be quite fascinating. So there's a whole lot more information on my website. Here's the address, writerinstitute.org. I encourage people to go there. You can download all this for free. There's over 6,000 pages of this. If you have insomnia, this is a great solution. There are these slides and a whole lot more slides as well. So I'll stop there.